Welcome to Opera Out of the Box, unpacking opera piece by piece. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell, and today I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Evtishia Papanicolaou, henceforth known as Effie, musicologist and professor at Bowling Green State University. We're also welcoming back Dr. Douglas Forsyth, henceforth known as Doug, if that's okay with you, a professor and historian at BGSU. And by phone, we have Dr. Jane Sylvester, a musicologist on faculty at the University of Missouri Kansas City Conservatory. Welcome to everyone.
Thank you, Brad.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The theme today is Puccini's Tosca, which is happening October 18th and 20th, 2024 at Toledo Opera. More information at toledoopera.org. The title of the episode is Shabby Little Shocker. Maybe we should start there because it's something that people really don't know the history about. Who wants to take the lead on talking about that? I'm looking at you, Effie.
Okay, I will do that, and then Jane can chime in. So this is a phrase that has been used and misused in popular culture, but it actually comes from a very famous and important musicologist. His name was Joseph Kerman. He wrote a book, Opera as Drama, it was published in 1988. And this is where you find this moniker, this phrase. Shabby little shocker. He used this phrase to describe Tosca. It was not done out of snobbery. I don't want people to think that this, you know, highfalutin musicologist is talking down Puccini and Tosca for various reasons. He actually had a very specific agenda. And his agenda was the propagation of what was known in musicology as the superiority of the Austro-German musical canon. So any kind of music really outside of the Austro-German tradition was seen with suspicion. And that went on for many decades. Kerman was not the first one to put down opera. And Jane can tell us more about her experience as a PhD student in musicology. I'm a lot older, so I was not here in the 80s when the book came out. And it created, you know, a kind of, it was in the tradition of musicology. But in the 90s, it was all of obsolete. In the 80s, if you wanted to be an opera scholar like Jane is, it would be seen with a lot of suspicion and derision. Mm. You want to do opera studies? What? This is not legitimate music unless you do Richard Wagner, right? Yeah. Richard Wagner was legitimate because he was German, because he had been studied to death. But Italian opera was seen as too popular, too banal. There is nothing really to talk about there. And it was only around this time that Verdi became kind of a prominent figure in opera studies. And Puccini was still relegated to the sidelines. Mm. He was someone who was still seen as not too serious. What are we going to talk about with Puccini? It's just popular music. And that was something that plagued Puccini reception since Puccini was alive for 100 years and or more.
Yeah.
So that's where it's coming from. It's not meant to say Puccini is so horrible, and it was not written yesterday. So I want our audiences to understand that we are not calling Tosca a shabby little shocker. But this phrase belongs to this tradition. And things have changed tremendously since 1988.
How have they changed, in your estimation?
Well, academia, of course, is a lot more accepting of, right now, everything. Any type of music, any kind of methodological bias or motivation is part of the canon now.
Yeah.
We don't leave out anybody and anything. But that was won really with hard work. And people like Joseph Kerman and many others are the founders of musicology in the United States. So we need to give them their dues, even though they didn't always get it right, because socially, politically, culturally, we're not ready for that.
Jane, do you agree with what Effie is saying?
Yeah, I think Effie, I really, really agree how Effie has analyzed Kerman's position as a 20th century scholar. And I think now, to kind of situate Kerman's ideology within contemporary opera scholarship, because as Effie nicely mentioned, we have so much more acceptance and welcoming of many, many different genres of studies. And opera studies is certainly a more well-established realm of sub-studies within the discipline. That I think one of the things that's interesting within the realm of Italian opera studies is that people have since used Kerman's idea of the shabby little shocker and as a way to justify the importance of Italian opera. You know, scholars in the 90s and the early 2000s would often use like formalistic analysis to justify the sort of musical merit of works of Puccini and by some of his Italian operatic contemporaries. So kind of using these older tools as a means to justify the merit of this music. Where now, not that these tools are a bad thing by any means, I think that there's more acceptance of using a lot, you know, a lot more tools in the toolbox, so to say, to examine this music that is rooted both in the music itself, but of course in the sociopolitical context as well, which is something that I do in my work and then many of my colleagues in my subfield also do in their work. So it's, as Effie said, a really, really important point of development in the discipline, and it's actually acted as a really significant pivot that we can now reflect upon.
I do have a comment, though. You know, when I was reading up on the opera, I was interested to discover that in Puccini's own days, that famous musicians who were a bit younger than him actually expressed their esteem for him, including some people that I wouldn't have suspected would have been admirers, including Arnold Schoenberg and Alban Berg and Anton Webern, right? The second Viennese school. Exactly, who were obviously going in a completely different direction with respect to melody and tonality than Puccini himself did. Also, Janáček, Stravinsky, and Ravel expressed their esteem for him. Mahler hated Tosca, and I'm curious about that. I was hoping you guys would explain to me by the end of this session why Mahler hated Tosca.
I don't know. I have a Mahler question in my quiz, so we may table that until a little bit later. But we're going to talk about the play by Victorien Sardou, and also a gentleman that I was not that aware of, Cesare Lombroso, who founded criminology in Italy. Jane, let's hear from you, because you kind of specialize in these two gentlemen. I wonder if you can tell us about the influence of Victorien Sardou as well as Cesare Lombroso.
Sardou and Lombroso, I'll start from their sort of connective point. Lombroso was, you know, by all modern accounts, a deeply, deeply problematic sociocultural figure. But in the late 19th and very early 20th century in Italy, he was considered by many an esteemed scientist. And his influence was not only amongst academics, but it was among literary figures and artists, which is something that I explore in my research. And among those figures was Sardou. Sardou wrote in a number of letters that are actually preserved in the Lombroso Archive, which is a fantastic research space in Turin, Italy. And he remarked about Lombroso's inspiration upon his work in a number of his different publications of plays. So from that point, we already have this sort of immediate connection of Sardou seeking Lombroso's ideas as a way to inform his own modes of characterization. And then what we have in Tosca is that we have Sardou's text is the primary text from which Puccini and his librettist sourced from. So Sardou's text was a five-act melodrama, essentially, that Puccini and his librettist reduced to three acts. And with that, some of the things that were removed from the context were the characters of Cavaradossi and Angelotti and how their relationship in the opera is already pre-established. But in the play, the sensibility of their political leanings was something that was explicated in much more detail. And essentially the transformation that Puccini and Giacosa and Illica do together is to create a greater sense of lyricism for all of the characters, which of course makes sense when we're setting these characters within an operatic context. But within that, we have sort of this adjustment of the political tenor of the work, so to say. So that would be sort of my starting point for how Sardou is this sort of interlocutor between the world of Lombroso and what we have to sort of manifest in the operatic libretto.
Yeah. Do you think that this is Puccini's most political opera?
It's really hard to say. You know, something we were briefly chatting about before the start of the podcast that I always want to give an air of caution to is that Puccini as an individual was almost vehemently apolitical. But what's interesting for us as contemporary listeners that have like the knowledge of history as a point of retrospection is that we can see that there are so many figures around and elements of reception history that really actually make a work that maybe wasn't positioned as political into something that was political. I might be biased, but I do think that this is among the most political of his works, especially when we think about the connection to Lombroso and how powerful and problematic he was as a cultural figure within Italy in this post-unification era, which was really this interesting and fascinating time in Italy of forging a sense of self-identification. It's very much tied up with nationalistic politics, and Tosca is really sort of pinned in the middle of this, you know, longer trajectory from what we have from Italy's unification to the dawn of fascism in the 1920s.
Well, on that note, let's do the first part of our quiz. I have a shabby little quiz for you guys. Ooh. Let me pull up some shabby little music here. You have a choice, Carmen or Grieg. Which do you like?
Carmen.
I would personally Carmen? Choose Carmen, but...
Okay. There's Carmen for you. All right. I have five questions here. This is about famous stage works that initially had terrible premieres, but are now celebrated classics. I'll read the three choices. You choose which is the right one. And don't tell anybody until the very end, so we can all play along, okay? Which of the following operas by Puccini had a disastrous premiere in 1900? Was it... Well, it was actually... I don't know if it was 1900. Anyway, that's why we have two musicologists here. La Boheme, Tosca, or Madame Butterfly? Now, don't tell me your answer. Okay, the second question is, which ballet by Tchaikovsky was initially deemed a failure when it premiered in 1877, but is now a classic? That is The Nutcracker, Swan Lake, or Sleeping Beauty? One of the three is correct. After that, we have which Beethoven symphony was poorly received at its premiere, but is now considered one of the most familiar classical works of all time? Is it the Symphony No. 5, Symphony No. 3, the Eroica, or Symphony No. 9, the Choral Symphony by Beethoven? Our fourth question is, which ballet by Igor Stravinsky famously caused a riot at its premiere in 1913? Is it the Firebird, Petrushka, or the Rite of Spring? And finally, Anton Bruckner's Symphony No. 3 was so poorly received that what happened during the premiere? Is it A, the conductor walked off stage, B, Bruckner had a breakdown, or C, the audience walked out before the end? I like that Bruckner had a breakdown, the alliteration, right? It's kind of like shabby little shocker. It sticks in your craw, as it were. So now let's go back, and I'll give you the answers. We'll see if you got all of them right. The first one, which of the following operas by Puccini had a disastrous premiere? That was Madame Butterfly, of course. Madame Butterfly, opening night audience, openly jeered, booed, and hissed throughout the performance. And Butterfly was mocked for its tragic heroine, was described as a secondhand copy of Mimi from Bohème. You all got that right, I assume?
Well, not in 1900, though.
I know, that's what tripped me up.
Yeah.
That's Tosca. The second question is, actually, I need to get my shabby music here. Let's try this other music. Okay. You recognize that?
Very seasonally appropriate.
Yeah, right. Anyway, so the second question was, which ballet by Tchaikovsky was initially deemed a failure? That would be Swan Lake. Swan Lake, initially deemed a failure when it premiered. The ballet, now the world's second most performed after Nutcracker, is only one of the most popular ballets of all time. Not only one of the popular ballets of all time, but also has music and a narrative that permeates throughout our culture. That's my stab at musicology right there. Right?
You can stab all the you want.
Yeah, it seems apropos to Tosca as well. All right. Which Beethoven symphony was poorly received at its premiere? I mean, you can make an argument for the Third Symphony, but I would say the Fifth Symphony had a bad premiere, right? And now we all know
yeah,
the call of
dreadful,
fate.
Dreadful evening.
Yeah. Oh, right. It went on for a long time. Yeah, it was cold.
Yes. Haydn got all the best musicians in Vienna, and Beethoven had the worst.
Yeah. Yeah, and they had to stop it partway into one passage and start again from the very beginning. You know, if that happened in today's culture, it'd be perfectly acceptable, right?
It depends.
Yeah, depends on the situation. Anyway, you'll all get this. Which ballet by Igor Stravinsky caused a riot at its premiere? 1913, that would be The Rite of Spring, of course. You're all nodding. Okay. Jane, you're virtually nodding on the phone.
Yes.
And the last one is Anton Bruckner. His Symphony No. 3 was so poorly received. What happened during the premiere? A, the conductor walked off stage. B, Bruckner had a breakdown. Or C, the audience walked out before the end. Who wants to offer an answer?
They're all plausible.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Jane, do you know? No?
This was the one I don't know.
Well, the answer is C. The audience walked out before the end. The concert was a complete disaster. Yeah, Bruckner was evidently a bad conductor, and he tried to conduct this piece, and the audience was not sympathetic to his work nor to his conducting, and they left the hall as the music played on. Sort of like Haydn's Farewell Symphony without, you know, meaning to be that way, right? So
in
that's
reverse,
the first.
Yeah.
Yeah. In reverse. I like that better.
I don't think we should leave Sardou until we talk a little bit about Sardou and Puccini and what
right.
Puccini at least got directly from Sardou, and that is the acting of Sarah Bernhardt. Sardou wrote this play specifically for this superstar of the 19th century, this theatrical monster, this amazing, formidable actress who is still, you know, known today for her theatrical performances. And it became a vehicle for Sarah Bernhardt. She was known as La Tosca. She performed this role more than anybody else at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century until the end of her life. And actually, and I don't know if this is 100% correct, but all the sources I read about Bernhardt, including a biography, said that at one of her performances in 1905, jumping off the parapet at the end of the performance, she injured her knee. And it became so bad that she got gangrene. Mm. And it was the reason why her leg was amputated about 10 years later. So what Puccini got from that was the incredible acting, which he saw. He himself saw Sarah Bernhardt perform La Tosca. Now, mind you, he saw it in French. And one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that these actresses, like, you know, Sarah Bernhardt, when she was performing La Tosca, which was in French, she was not performing Tosca in French all over the world, including here in the United States. I have a review from a performance she did in Canton, Ohio, which I will talk about during my pre-performance talk.
That deserves one of these. If you can identify the voice.
Pavarotti?
It's Pavarotti, right?
No, it's not Pavarotti. Speaking as a former tenor, I think this is the most amazing voice of all time, but, you know, I'm biased.
Gilli?
No, it was Corelli.
Oh, Corelli. Of course.
Who's calling me? Let me see.
Hello, I got disconnected at the sounds of Pavarotti.
Oh, okay.
There you go again.
It was not Pavarotti, it was actually Franco Corelli.
Really? Oh my gosh, it sounded like Pav over the phone.
Yeah. Well, you have an excuse. Effie doesn't have that excuse.
I am not excused.
No, but great
Effie,
voice.
Did you think the same thing, though?
I said Pavarotti, yeah.
Yes! My vibrato sounded just like it.
I just want an excuse to play that again because, you know, tenors. It's all about the tenor, right?
Sounds great.
Yeah.
It's fabulous. And I have to admit, upon a second listening, the timbre, the tone of his voice, even over the phone, I could then tell it wasn't Pavarotti. Just needed two listens.
So Puccini actually met with Sardou.
Yes.
And he you know, showed him what he had at various stages in the development of the opera.
Mm-hmm.
He was shocked that Sardou, in his stage directions for the play, had the Castel San Angelo and the St. Peter's Basilica on opposite sides of the Tiber River instead of on the same side. He felt that he had to correct that in his version, which was for an Italian audience.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Well, what elements of the play did Puccini really latch onto, and what did he do with that story himself and his librettists, Illica and Giacosa?
Well, he simplified it, for one thing, right? He reduces it from five acts to three, which you kind of have to do, I think, if you're turning a play into opera. I think he shrunk the politics out of it.
Yeah.
He changes Tosca, the figure, and I think that she becomes more complex and interesting, actually, in the opera than she was in the original, despite Sarah Bernhardt's role. No. It's more melodrama and less politics, the opera.
But and this is open to anybody. How did the opera influence other operas of the time? I mean, how did it stand out? You talk about Puccini being second to Verdi, you know, earlier. How did Puccini make his mark with this opera? How does it viewed in the world of opera? What effect did it have on the people who were making operas at the time?
Well, I think that two sort of strategies or two big takeaways that I immediately think of are, one is that there was much more explicit depictions of violence in Tosca that was deeply influential through the sort of twilight of the operatic Verismo movement for about the next 20 years. The Act Two scene where Tosca stabs Scarpia and is staged very obviously, and also Cavaradossi's torture scenes that were understood as very, very gruesome, that certainly had an impact on the direction of Verismo, conceived as very melodramatic. I would also say, and this is not the first time that Puccini did this, but dabbling with Wagner's techniques of the leitmotif, Puccini's other colleagues that were a part of the Giovane Scuola, the young school at the time, very much did this, but I think that this was something that especially critics were really interested in, was Puccini's manipulation of this technique of manipulating motivic material to suit dramatic ends that were different from Wagner's style of using it. But I don't know if Effie and Doug want to chime in with other remarks about this too.
Well, and we can talk about Puccini's musical style as it developed as well. I mean, it's so interesting to think of Verdi versus Puccini. From a singer standpoint, I would tell you that Verdi is difficult because of the tessitura, the place where it lives, basically, on the scale. And Puccini is difficult because everything is doubled. You know, it's you really need to sing in order to be heard in that opera. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. And I'm looking at Doug and Effie right now.
I will quote my favorite singer, Maria Callas, who said she disliked Puccini, and she could sing everything in the world. And out of Puccini, she chose Tosca as one of the best operas that she sang.
Yeah.
That says a lot, because she considered Wagner to be easy to sing, and Puccini not so much. The larger topic about Tosca is that, of course, it was not very well received when it was performed in 1900, but that goes more to the politics of the time. Puccini was never seen as a serious composer because he was popular. And this is something that we have seen not only with Puccini, but with some other composers. And we can also transfer it to today's genres, right? That if something is too popular, then maybe there are no merits there, right? That's the understanding that we have.
Yeah.
And Puccini suffered for that because critics would be extremely critical of his music, of everything about his operas. But the audiences loved him. And he became extremely popular and famous and rich because the audiences followed every single production of his performances. It's like, you know, somebody comparing, I don't know, soap opera and Ibsen, right? So soap opera is gratuitous. And they thought that Tosca specifically was too gratuitous sensationalism. And that it didn't really live up to the standards of modernism of the time. You know, it didn't really express the anxieties of the time. So that's what I have to say.
Yeah, my understanding is these first three operas that were successful for Puccini, La Bohème, and then Tosca and Madame Butterfly, in all three cases, critics were lukewarm, but the audience reception was strong and favorable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Verdi, you know, he said that the audience was always right. If they wanted a high C instead of a high G, they got the high C because that's what they wanted. So he was in the service of who was going to be listening to the opera.
Well, that's what every good composer should be doing. That's what Mozart was doing. That's what many other composers of operas were doing. So that's nothing unusual. But Puccini came at the cracks of a very interesting artistically and socially and historically period. And the 1900 is also a period in Italy that almost mirrors the anxieties, the political anxieties that are included in the play that it was, you know, that reflect 1800, 100 years before. So all of these things made Puccini an extremely popular figure with the audiences, but not so popular with the mainstream critics, and also especially with scholars. And that's where Joseph Kerman came from about 80 years later. Yeah. To go back to the opening of our podcast here.
Shabby little shocker. Shabby little podcast, as it were. Let's do the second part of our quiz, okay? So you have that music. Which do you like, the Western version or the Latin American version?
Definitely Latin American.
Yeah, you agree, Jane?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. There's Latin American Carmen. All right, the questions are as follows. Which play by Anton Chekhov was poorly received at its premiere but is now a classic of world theater? Would that be The Cherry Orchard, The Seagull, or Uncle Vanya? Number 7. Which of the Shakespeare's plays was not well received in his time but is now one of his most performed tragedies? Was it King Lear? Was it Macbeth? Or was it Hamlet? A, B, or C? Next question. Which symphony by Gustav Mahler? We talked about Mahler earlier. Anyway, which symphony of Gustav Mahler's was criticized for its length and complexity at its premiere but is now highly praised and often performed? Is it the Symphony No. 2, the Resurrection Symphony, Symphony No. 1, the Titan Symphony, or the Symphony No. 8, the Symphony of 1,000? And no spoilers, but I'll give you the answer right now. It's all three of those. I mean, basically everybody thought he was long-winded, as it were. Anyway, Which Broadway musical by Stephen Sondheim was not well received at its opening, but has since become a beloved classic? Was it Company, Sweeney Todd, or Merrily We Roll Along? And finally, which work by Johannes Brahms was initially received coldly by audiences, particularly in Vienna? Would it be a German Requiem? Would it be his Symphony No. 1 or his Piano Concerto No. 1? Okay, so we've got all the questions there. Let's go back to the beginning and see who got that correct. Which play by Anton Chekhov had a disastrous premiere? It says here 1896, but I'm not trusting dates on any of this now. So which of these? The Cherry Orchard, The Seagull, or Uncle Vanya? Do we have any guesses?
I would go with C.
C, Uncle Vanya. It was actually B, The Seagull. The opening night of the first production was a famous failure. The actress playing Nina was so intimidated by the hostility of the audience that she lost her voice. And Chekhov himself left the audience and spent the last two acts behind the scenes. So, The Seagull by Anton Chekhov. Which of Shakespeare's plays fit into this category? Is it King Lear, Macbeth, or Hamlet? A, B, or C? What do you say, Jane? You still there?
Oh, God. Yeah, I'm still here. I'm going to go, oh, gosh. I'm teaching this to my students right now, so I'm just going to go for B, Macbeth.
It was actually A, King Lear, the sad, sad version of Lear. And you have to put it in context because they didn't want to see a king lose his throne. They'd just been through the Restoration, installing a king back on the throne after the years of Oliver Cromwell leading the nation. So King Lear, definitely. The Stephen Sondheim Broadway musical. Which one of those had a disastrous premiere? Is it A, Company, B, Sweeney Todd, or C, Merrily We Roll Along? Any guesses? Any guesses, Jane?
Oh, gosh. I'm going to say Merrily We Roll Along.
That is correct.
Nice.
Yeah. Critics and audiences alike felt that the book was problematic. The theme left a sour taste in their mouths, hampered by several critical reviews, which came before its official opening, as well as more negative ones published afterward. It ran for 16 performances and 44 previews. Finally, which work of Johannes Brahms was initially booed by the audience at its premiere? Would it be the Piano Concerto No. 1, the Symphony No. 1, or a German Requiem? I did those backwards, so A is a German Requiem, B, Symphony No. 1, C, Piano Concerto No. 1. Any idea there?
The concerto.
Yes, the Piano Concerto was a massive departure from other concertos of the period. It's very dark and stormy. And
it gorgeous.
Nowadays, you know, the performance standards are probably higher than they were back at the premiere. But nowadays, we worship it along with the other works of Johannes Brahms. So that's the end of our quiz. Let's get back on track with Tosca. Jane, tell us about the premiere of Tosca and how that setting may have affected the opera's reception at the time.
So the premiere of Tosca took place in Rome, which was perfect for the setting of the play, which is so centered within the city. And it premiered shortly after the dawn of a new century. It was 1900. The premiere was in January. And it was specifically at the Teatro dell'Opera, the opera theater in Rome. Now, we might think of Rome as, you know, the capital of Italy today, this cultural epicenter of it having a really, really illustrious opera theater. But especially at that time, the Teatro dell'Opera was a bit of a little brother or a little sister, so to say, in comparison with these other juggernaut theaters that were in Italy at the time, namely La Scala in Milan in the north and the Teatro San Carlo in Naples, that was just a bit south. So the Teatro dell'Opera, I have worked with closely in some of my own research, and learned from their fabulous archivist and curator that Tosca, as well as Cavalleria Rusticana, 10 years earlier in 1890, and then the Italian premiere of Il Tridico, the Puccini's triptych of short operas, all premiered at this Roman theater. And so I thought this was really fascinating because all of these were sort of cutting edge at the time. And this was something that the theater really was proud of. Because they were, you know, not as well established, they were a bit of a newer theater in comparison to La Scala or the San Carlo. The Teatro dell'Opera was really, really, they were huge advocates for new works. And even today, a lot of the collaborative efforts they do, they try to bring in different interdisciplinary artists. The theater was a really important epicenter for Italian performances of the Ballet Russe, that it really kind of self-positioned its own identity as a place to celebrate the cutting edge within opera and sort of like operatic theatrical production. So it was interesting, and it's interesting to reflect today. Now, of course, the Teatro dell'Opera is a bigger theater. It's more established. But thinking about the nature of, you know, smaller or medium-sized theaters or theaters that just haven't had the time to become as established within, you know, sort of a cultural sensibility, that they have this ability to become more experimental, to celebrate novelty. And that could be, for instance, kind of the hook that brings people in, as opposed to other institutions that might be more rooted in recreating traditions. The Teatro dell'Opera was really a trendsetter within Italy at the turn of the 20th century, which was really cool. And not a lot of people actually consider that with the history of Tosca.
Doug, you talked a little bit about this at our last podcast. How did the social mores, you know, develop in the wake of the opera? I mean, what was the political climate at the time?
Yeah, so it's a tense moment in Italy. The 1990s was a difficult decade in Italian politics. There was a banking crisis in 1893. In 1894, you have this social movement in Sicily called the Fasci Siciliani, which gets put down in blood by the army and at the beginning of 1894. Then in 1896, the Italians lose a battle in Ethiopia. It's the worst defeat of a colonial power facing African troops in the age of high imperialism. In 1898, you have social unrest in northern cities, including in Milan, and 80 people are killed by the army in Milan in May 1898. And then we have a general. The king appoints a general as a prime minister, and this is only the second time in the history of unified Italy that you've got a general leading the country. And this general had put down another popular revolt in Bari, although he had done so without declaring martial law. So this is the climate when the opera premieres, and you know we have this story in here, which Puccini inherited from Sardou to a fair extent, but it pits the forces of reaction against the forces of liberalism, really, right? And it's up in the air what's going to happen. In fact, a conservative politician named Sidney Sonnino had written an article arguing that the experiment with democratization wasn't working in Italy, which was published in 1897. And he said, we've got to go back to the Constitution of 1848 and strengthen the executive and diminish the democratic elements in the Italian political system. And that was very much, and he was the sort of the amanuense Greece behind the government of Pilou, right? This general who was the prime minister. But within a year, the situation changes. There are elections and the left does well. The king appoints a prime minister to the left, on the left side of the political spectrum. And by 1901, we've got the most progressive era in the politics of liberal Italy has kind of begun. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but think that opera goers must have taken this delicate situation with them when they watched the action here. There wasn't a huge political backlash. Luigi Pello and the Queen, Margherita, actually attended the premiere in Rome, and there's no record that they objected to it. I mean, of course, the Bourbon monarchy, right, which are the brute Scarpia in the opera is representing the Bourbon monarchy. And nobody was singing the praises of the Bourbon monarchy in 1900. And, you know, Pelot too would have agreed with, or he would have been opposed to the Pope running a state, right, in Rome. But you would think that people would have taken their politics with them to the opera and would have seen things in it that would have resonated with them.
Yeah, well, a lot of people considered, going back to Verdi again, he was, you know, they thought of him as a potential politician, right? And I wonder how involved Puccini was with the politics around him, if he just expressed it in his art or if he attached himself somehow to various movements.
Yeah, so, you know, one thing I've learned in preparing for this roundtable is that Puccini was rather apolitical. I just assumed that he was kind of political. He writes La Bohème, which is about about starving artists in Paris, right? And you think that that's a kind of a left-leaning topic. And then he writes Tosca, which, you know, pits this reactionary Bourbon monarchy torturing liberals, right, in Rome in 1800. And then we have Modern Butterfly, which seems to have anti-imperial connotations, right? We have this Japanese woman who's being misused by an American military officer.
Yeah.
But he really was kind of apolitical. And he was, you know, he grasped onto this play by Sardou because it was popular at the time. And, of course, Sardou's politics seeps into the opera, too. Puccini himself, he really wasn't even interested in local politics in Viareggio, where he had his house, apparently. He did later on, at the end of his life, he met with Mussolini in 1923 because he wanted to become senatore a vita. But the reason he wanted to become a senator was not because he was interested in contributing to Italian politics. It was because Giuseppe Verdi, before him, had been senatore a vita. And he thought that his own position in Italian culture could only be cemented if he also attained that title. And Mussolini came through for him before he died of throat cancer in 1924.
Wow. Yeah, Puccini died of throat cancer.
Puccini, yes, exactly.
Wow. So who gets the last word here? I guess I'll go around and ask you all, what is the enduring popularity of Tosca? Why is it so popular today? I've talked about this with a few different people, but I'm curious, you know, audiences here in Toledo may or may not have seen Tosca before, but the question is, why is it so palatable for today's audience, and why should people go see it? Let's start with you, Doug, since you're right there.
It's my wife's favorite opera.
Well, that's it right there. That's reason to go.
I asked her about this, and she likes the figure of Tosca. She finds Tosca to be something of a feminist. She likes especially the aria Vice d'Arte, in which Tosca kind of explains her life. And the interesting thing about that is that I think it's Puccini is speaking in Vice d'Arte, too, because, you know, he was a guy who was more interested in his art than anything else, really. He also liked hunting and fast cars. And Puccini also wrote some of his wife into the character of Tosca. His wife, Elvira, was married to another man, and she had left this man because of his various affairs, right, with other women, and was living in sin with Puccini. Was kind of jealous, by the way, too, but was a strong-willed woman, and Puccini is clearly celebrating a strong-willed woman in the opera.
Yeah. Effie, you have something to say. You always look like you're about to speak, and you're waiting for others to finish.
I have so many thoughts in such little time. This opera and Puccini. Puccini, first of all, is beloved by audiences because you can't resist his music. No matter what critics might say, no matter what history might say, Puccini created beautiful music and immortal characters like Tosca, especially women. We also shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's fraught with modern contemporary issues. Mm-hmm. And for some of the audiences nowadays, these are lived experiences. sexual harassment, police brutality, sexism, abuse of power.
The more things change, the more they stay the same, right?
Exactly, exactly. So it is very contemporary in that respect. Yes, it's meant to reflect a very specific period of time, but it's really very modern in how it reflects also our time.
Yeah. Jane, I'll give you the last word if you have anything you want to add as a sort of a cherry on top there.
Yeah, I think my reflections are complementary to Effie in that there's sort of a timelessness of this opera, which is kind of funny because I think a lot of productions will stress the site-specific nature of it, where really these very human elements of social mores and social vices are things that have an appeal across history. And to complement what Doug said, the character of Tosca, I think, is very enduring because she represents so many contrasts, especially as she's invoiced in this opera. You know, she's self-sacrificial, she's quite human in that she's superstitious, she's jealous, she's pious. Sometimes she can be vain, she can be deeply sweet. And so to have this leading heroine that's so multifaceted, she's both a product of her time, but also ahead of her time, and I think a voice of our time in a way, too, that is really enduring.
Well, the love story that exists in the opera, I mean, is definitely apropos to what people can experience today. It sort of is a gateway to this. This story is a vehicle for the music, and that kind of gets at what Effie is talking about. That the music is really why people go see the opera. And this is one of the operas that has stood the test of time, and the music is still wonderful for those who have heard it many, many times and those who have not. So I want to thank all three of you for coming in today and giving us a little context. There are so many things that we could say about the opera Tosca, but the best thing to do is to actually try and see it and experience what we've been talking about all this time. You've been listening to Opera Out of the Box, a co-production of WGTE Public Media and Toledo Opera, with additional support from Ohio Humanities. You can find previous episodes online at our website, WGTE.org. And of course, you can dive into all things Toledo Opera at their website, which is ToledoOpera.org. I want to thank my guests today once again, Effie Papanikolaou, Doug Forsyth, and Jane Sylvester. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell, and thank you for joining us for Opera Out of the Box.